Excellences, Mesdames et Messieurs.
Distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I'm pleased to welcome you to this important event, strengthening the resilience of small island developing states within the context of sustainable development. I also welcome our excellent panel and the very able moderator for the discussion this morning. Let me also extend a special welcome to Mr. Wu Hongbo, Under Secretary General for Economic and Social Affairs and Secretary General of the Third International Conference on Small Island Developing States. Mr. Wu Hongbo, your presence here signals a solid commitment to sustainable development, particularly that of SIDS, and a successful conference next year. Excellencies, the situation of small island developing states, and specifically their vulnerability and their potential for resilience, has already been clearly recognized by the international community, and it was reaffirmed in the outcome document of the RioPlus20 conference. Indeed, the raison d'etre for the Third International Conference on Small Island Developing States, to be held in Apia, Samoa, in September next year, can be framed as part of the drive to build resilience through the efforts of these small island developing states themselves and through partnership with the international community. We should not simply discuss resilience. We also need concrete actions in order to build and strengthen it. The panelists in the roundtable should recommend actions as well as provide further stimuli to our own thinking towards action-oriented strategies for strengthening and building resilience in small island developing states. It is crucial for us as representatives of the international community to monitor developments in small island developing states for several reasons. First and most important, the international community and all of us have the responsibility of assisting our fellow member states. In addition, the situation of the small island developing states should be considered precursors to developments within the entire international community. There are many countries with similar difficulty experiences and challenges. The best practices and lessons learned that will be shared here at this round table are also valuable to their search for solutions to their special situations. As we prepare our consideration of the agenda item on the further implementation of the Mauritius strategy, let us use this panel discussion to reflect on how we as the international community can best partner with the small island developing states to ensure that the building and strengthening of their resilience can be achieved. Sustainable development is at the heart of the development discourse. And although we are focused today on the small island developing states, this panel is of significant value to all member states and their sustainable development aspirations. Therefore, I encourage you to fully participate in this discussion. And now, without further ado, I now invite the Undersecretary General for Economic and Social Affairs and Secretary General of the Third International Conference on Small Island Developing States to deliver his keynote address. Mr. Wu Hongbo, you have the floor.
Thank you, Ambassador, Chair of the Second Committee, Madam Moderator, dear panelists, excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. It is my honor to join you today at this special event of the Second Committee. The topic of the discussion, strengthening the resilience of a small island developing states within the context of sustainable development, is one of critical importance to the SIDS. As the Secretary General of the Third International Conference on SIDS, I applaud the Second Committee for organizing this timely discussion and for highlighting the role of resilience in meeting the sustainable developing challenges facing small island developing states. During the past months, in the course of national, regional, and interregional preparations for the SEAS Conference in Samoa next September, I've listened intently to the concerns and aspirations of the SEAS member states. While many SEAS have achieved remarkable progress in implementing the Barbados Program of Action and the Mauritius Strategy through their own efforts and through international partners, they continue to suffer from their own particular vulnerabilities. As a result of their unique vulnerabilities, as well as the constraints they face in adjusting to external shocks, many SEAS face uncertain prospects in achieving a sustainable future for SEAS communities across the world's oceans and seas. Therefore, the need to strengthen the resilience of SEAS is of paramount importance to SEAS. It represents one of their main pathways to sustainable development. SEAS want to focus on overcoming their challenges. They've made this clear. They want to rise above the constraints that have hindered their developmental prospects and have made their own efforts to build resilience. They are also ready to fully utilize the momentum of the post-2015 development agenda. Future sustainable development goals that reflect the aspirations of SEAS will inspire further global action and generating partnership in support of SEAS. For the international community, we have a responsibility to assist the SEAS in their endeavors towards achieving sustainable development. We acknowledged that the SEAS are a special case in sustainable development. We agreed during Rio Plus 20 that these member states continue to deserve global support. That recognition led to the call for convening the third international conference on SEAS. Excellencies, SEAS have indicated a design to have genuine and durable partnerships towards achieving sustainable development and proposed it as the theme of the Samoa Conference. The international community thus have an opportunity to provide enhanced assistance to the SEAS through renewed and reinforced partnerships. Helping the SEAS in strengthening their resilience can be one such a partnership initiative. The journey to Samoa will soon resume at the global level, with the entire international community joining in and deliberating on the blueprint for the further sustainable development options, opinions, and options for seats. This special event is therefore both timely and indispensable. It will allow us to have a deeper appreciation for one of the fundamental concerns of a seat, while considering how best we can help in addressing their concerns. I'm confident that your discussions will be fruitful and will produce innovative and practical ideas to address some of the challenges facing seats, particularly as we prepare for the conference next year, as well as for the post-2015 development agenda. I wish you a very productive event. Thank you very much.
Je remercie Monsieur.
I thank Mr. Wu Hongbo, Undersecretary General for ADESA, for his statement. I am certain that the ideas in his speech will be of inspiration to us this morning. I thank you again. Ladies and gentlemen, let us now move to our panel discussion. This morning, we will have the benefit of the presence of three distinguished experts. I would like to thank them for their willingness to share their time, knowledge, and experience with us. I will now introduce them. Mr. Osman Mohamed, Executive Chair of the Commission Maurice Île Durable, and there we're talking about the island of Mauritius. Her Excellency Mrs. Makurita Barrow, Permanent Representative of Kiribati to the United Nations, and Mr. Peter Allam, Assistant Director of the Strategy, Policy and Review Department at the International Monetary Fund, and finally, Mr. José Regidor García, Rector of the Universidad de Las Palmas de Gran Canaria and member of the Board of Trustees of the University Consortium of Small Island Developing States. Also with us is Her Excellency Ms. Janine Coy Felsen, Special Advisor on Legal Matters in the Office of the President of the General Assembly. She has obliged us this morning in agreeing to be the moderator for the panel discussion. Without further ado, then, I now hand over the floor to Madame Janine Coy Felsen, who will moderate our special event. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am indeed honored to moderate this panel on the strengthening of the resilience of SIDS within the context of sustainable development. As we've heard both from the Chair and the Undersecretary General, small island developing states will only achieve sustainable development, their sustainable development objectives, through concrete actions at the national and international levels that address their varied challenges. What is critical is that those actions effectively match the magnitude of the challenges. Over the last 20 years, we have been focused on how to treat the economic, social, and environmental vulnerabilities of SIDS. Now, today's panel will demonstrate we are now engaging on a shift in focus on how to build the resilience of SIDS without losing sight of the endemic vulnerabilities that these member states face. We have four presentations which will respectively address the special case of SIDS, the means of implementation towards strengthening SIDS resilience building initiatives and options for SIDS, and finally, partnership among SIDS and for SIDS. At the end of the presentations, delegations will have an opportunity to present their responses and comments. But I don't want to delay any further, and I would like to begin with our first presentation by Mr. Osman Mohamed, with a little brief introduction. As you will have noted in the concept note, Mr. Mohamed has overseen the development of a national sustainable development strategy through the promotion of strategic areas in energy efficiency and independence. The strategy seeks to transform the social, economic, and environmental landscape of Mauritius. He has served on the private sector, and in 2003 joined the Mauritian administration. He is an engineer and holds an MBA as well. Under Mr. Mohamed's direction, the National Development Strategy has become a model approach of best practices in multi-stakeholder consultation and partnership building, working with such institutions and donors as the World Bank and the French Development Agency. Mr. Mohamed, you have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, Excellencies, panelists, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, all protocols observed. First of all, I would like to thank the organizer for the invitation. I'm going to deliver a PowerPoint presentation, sandwiched in between with a short clip of 7 minutes or so. And to begin with, I will ask for my first slide, please. Maurice Île Durable is the Sustainable Development Initiative of the Republic of Mauritius. In short, I will time and again refer it to MID. Launched in 2008 by the Honorable Prime Minister in the context of the soaring price of the barrel, whereas in 2008 the main focus was on energy, in 2010, December 2010, the Prime Minister revisited MID to make it a societal project that seeks to transform the economic, environmental, and social landscape of Mauritius. It contains five E's, the MID five E's: energy, environment, employment, education, and equity. So in July 2011, we embarked on a consultative process comprising of working groups set to cast recommendations as what the civil society of Mauritius wants for its sustainable development. Why six working groups? Because environment was big, we split it into two. And they met over 24 working sessions and they produced 600 recommendations in six reports. These are the basis of MID. In February 2012, we recruited a consultant, Mott MacDonald, which started in its assignment, and that culminated in 14th of June 2013 by government approving the MID Policy, Strategy and Action Plan. In between, the work of the consultant was supervised by through 20 steering committees comprising of ministries representative and also 16 strategic committees at PMO, Prime Minister's Office, where all the chairpersons of the working group are permanent members and comprising of private sector and other NGOs representative. This is the process we have followed so far for MID. And it has benefited the support of the UNDP in Mauritius, the Agence Française de Développement, and the European Union delegation to some extent. Next slide, please. So, memorabilia of the 24 working groups. Next slide, please. While the process, while the consultant was doing its work, we went down to the through public meetings to meet the population. And we did that at the municipal council, five of them, and the district council, to do three things basically: to explain to the population what MID is all about, what can they do to contribute to MID, and what are their recommendations, which were also taken on board in the work of the consultant. The national vision for Maurice Île Durable is to make Mauritius a model for sustainable development amongst its. Like, while the policy formulation was on, no time was wasted. We embarked on several initiatives, projects, and actions. And on the day that it was approved by Cabinet, 14th of June 2013, we counted 207 of them. Many of them funded through the MID Fund. The MID Fund is a way of cross-subsidizing the polluting industry to the green industry. So Mauritius uses, among others, coal to produce electricity. Every ton of coal that enters the country, a levy is taken on it. And every liter of either diesel or gasoline that is used in Mauritius is also levied a certain amount. And this goes to the MID fund. And the MID fund uses that money in return to cross-subsidize other initiatives. Some of them are among the 27 projects and initiatives that we counted on the 14th June 2013, and this is ongoing. I would like, for the sake of example, refer to a few this morning. We have set up we are setting up a sustainability index on the stock exchange of Mauritius to give recognition to companies, private companies that are embarked on sustainability agenda. They are assessed on economic, environmental, social, and good governance. We have started taxing our vehicle based on their CO2 emissions rather than on their engine capacity. We started the work at the Prime Minister's office, and IMF completed the exercise with the Ministry of Finance. And in 2012, we had the second best air quality in the world, as assessed by the World Health Organization. We also went on TV, national TV, at prime time to broadcast EcoTV to explain to the population further what MID was all about. And this is a joint partnership between government and the private sector. About 170 families in Mauritius are now producing their own electricity and exporting the same to the grid. This is also an initiative throughout MID. Mauritius produces about 14% of its electricity through bagasse, which is a byproduct of sugarcane. And we used to export the molasses, but now we have a framework for the use of ethanol in Mauritius, and production is starting at the end of this month. So rather than exporting our molasses, it will be used for energy purposes in the country and in the region. We have set up MID clubs in school because we believe children are ambassadors of change, and the MID clubs comes with a specific terms of reference, and this is being replicated. One of the terms of reference is the community outreach program. Whatever they learn in school, in as far as sustainable development is concerned, they go down to the community and they share. While the process was on, several cabinet decisions were also taken, 40 of them. We've listed them on our website, a few of them. And for the sake of this morning, I will quote two. The first one relating to the agricultural sector, about the ecological cabinet approved on the 22nd of March, the ecological agriculture action plan in line with MID, and the project aims at gradually reducing the use of conventional pesticides on food crop plantation and replacing them by biopesticides. I must emphasize that waste management is one of the main concerns of the country, and landfilling is the least sustainable one. We are producing electricity through landfill gas in Mauritius, and this is a UNFCCC carbon registered project. We've got the private sector to come and industrially compost municipal waste, because our waste comprises of 70% of organic matter. Accompanying this initiative, we've distributed compost bin funded through the MID fund to the population, and this has substantially reduced the amount of waste going to landfill. And to further boost the use of locally produced compost, government last year put at the disposal of small planters 40 million rupees as subsidy. This is about $1.3 million to boost up the sector. Another cabinet decision was taken recently. Cabinet noted that under MID, Policy, Strategy and Action Plan, the contribution of renewable energy, meaning hydro, bagasse, wind, photovoltaic, landfill gas to energy, and the small independent power producer scheme, where the households are now producing their own electricity, will take the 17% of renewable energy to 23.4% of the total electricity generation in 2014. And this will set us on track for the 35% in 2025. All contracts have already been signed for these projects. We have about 66 megawatts worth of contracts already signed, out of a peak of 430 megawatt in Mauritius. Next slide, please. So there were six, wherever you see it's written in yellow on top, it's the Prime Minister's quote. It's there. I've left a copy to the organizers. 600 recommendations from civil society, transformed into 138 actions, 35 of which are policies in nature, cutting across the five E's, and 15 of them being overarching policies on interdisciplinary issues such as land management. Mauritius is a small country, and we feel that its sustainable and optimization of land use is very important. So overarching policy 06 of the MID Policy Strategy and Action Plan advocates to optimize land use through an effective and efficient land use planning process, because, and this is linked to environment, to energy, etc. And we have to ensure that we sustainably use the land for activities, economic and environmental issues that we have on the table. So the MID has also set targets across the five E's. We are going to look at them later. Next slide, please. The MID policy, strategy, and action plan is to be delivered through four main programs. Number one, the green economy. We have already started working on it. And in fact, at the end of this month, together with the UN system in Mauritius, we are having a major workshop to do two things: to explain to the population what the green economy is all about and how to mainstream green economy into development agenda of Mauritius. The next one is on ocean economy. Third one, cleaner, greener, pollution-free Mauritius. And the fourth one is energy, which is also a main concern to Mauritius, being far away from main producing oil countries. I would like to, at this stage, invite the audience to watch a short clip on MID, and then I will come back to finish the PowerPoint presentation.
Rio, 1994 Barbados. In line with these two international meetings, the Honourable Prime Minister, Dr. Navin Chandra Ramgoolam, launched an indigenous program called Maurice Île Durable.
C'est un projet de société, pas un projet énergétique. MID is essentially a vision that seeks to transform the environmental, economic and social landscape of our country. It is about sustainable development. It is about inclusive growth. MID is a national undertaking where every single citizen of this country, be it in Mauritius, in Rodrigues, in Agalega, in Saint-Brando, has an opportunity to participate in shaping the future of our country.
This societal project aims at making of Mauritius a world-renowned model for sustainable development. The MID vision frames sustainable development and economic growth under five thematic areas, the five E's, namely environment, energy, employment, education, and equity. Mauritius embarked in the process of developing its own policy, strategy, and action plan on sustainable development. While this process was on, no time was wasted, and more than 200 projects, sustainable projects and initiatives, were launched in parallel.
Maurice Île Durable, il concerne développement durable. Il concerne l'économie, le social et l'environnement. Il pour assurer que la génération qui vient après nous, je tiens à l'île Maurice qui est aussi bon qu'il est aujourd'hui, ou meilleur.
These include solar water heaters being distributed to more than 58,000 households. Schools and buildings were being equipped with photovoltaic cells, the gas-to-energy project at Marshy Coast, and the small independent power producer scheme being launched. In addition, more than 50,000 conventional street lamps were replaced by low-energy lamps, together with more than 1 million low-energy compact fluorescent lamps having been distributed. At the heart of the MID strategy lies the concept of reducing the amount of waste produced. A strategy has been put in place allowing the industrial composting of solid municipal waste. Up to now, more than 38,000 tons of these waste have been converted into compost. To encourage the use of compost, a subsidy amounting to 40 million rupees have been put at the disposal of small planters. An initial batch of 12,000 compost bins has also been distributed around the island in view of promoting household composting for a cleaner Mauritius. Our country has also embarked on a cleaner diesel with low sulfur content, one of the lowest in the African countries. The Ministry of Environment and Sustainable Development has also embarked on various projects, namely the installation of smoke meters and Tous étaient tout à fait campaign, amongst many others. Maurice Île Durable will become a reality only if there is a change in the mindset. To initiate this change, the MID Commission, together with the Ministry of Education and Human Resources, has embarked itself on an ambitious project of creating MID clubs in all schools of the island. Mauritius is already a welfare state and is now aiming at becoming a sustainable one, where equity will prevail. To further progress on this agenda, the government has created a dedicated Ministry of Social Integration and Economic Empowerment, as well as an Equal Opportunities Commission, not to forget the National Empowerment Foundation, operating under the aegis of the Ministry of Social Integration and Economic Empowerment. The MID policy formulation process was a participative democratic concept where intensive consultations were held. During 24 consultative workshops, more than 300 participants regrouped in six, each focusing on one of the five E's, culminated into more than 600 recommendations. The 14th of June 2013 marked a milestone in the Maurice Île Durable aspiration.
Comme Premier ministre, tout le temps dire, c'est un rapport de société. Et nous avons envie qu'il nous réussisse.
With the approval of the Maurice Île Durable Policy, Strategy and Action Plan by government. Built around the five E's, this policy, strategy and action plan, has more than 130 projects ready for implementation. These projects are regrouped under four priority programs, namely energy, cleaner, greener and pollution-free Mauritius, green economy and ocean economy. The plan is ready. Now it's time for action. We at the MID Commission are ready. Are you? If you are, let us be MID compliant.
Nous connaissons comment senti nous pour ici. Quand chaque dimon senti qui Maurice, c'est pas ce pays mais ce lacasse même.
Mindset change, very important. Word of the Prime Minister. You must have seen a lot of figures. The action plan is costed at, for the next 3 years at 6.26 billion rupees. One rupee is about 30, $1 US dollar is about 30 rupees. So we are talking about $200 million. A huge part of it will come from the private sector investment, but cross-subsidized by government for the purchase of electricity through wind farms and solar photovoltaic panels. We have about 230,000 households in Mauritius, so the MID fund has funded about 60,000 solar water heaters so far, and that has brought substantial reduction in our energy bill. We did a study recently, and we found out that solar water heater, the payback is about 2 years. So it's good investment from government. The energy the targets for MID are as follows. For energy, to achieve the national target of 35% of renewables by 2025. We are on track so far at for the next 1 year. We are going to be at 22.4, like I said earlier. But this will not, and we have to reduce our energy consumption in non-residential and public sector by 10% by 2020. We need three things for the target to occur, because otherwise it is going to be a moving target. We need energy efficiency. Government has set up an energy efficiency management office. government has revised the New Building Act, the Building Act, which used to date back 100 years, and now it has one of its main components, the sustainability aspect. The environment targets are to meet the environmental sustainability target of the MDGs. Mauritius has met most of its MDGs. And to reduce the ecological footprint so as to be in the upper quartile of performance of similar nations by 2020. In as far as economy and employment, the third E, the objective is to increase the percentage of green job from the current 6.3% as assessed by ILO in 2010 to 10% by 2020. We have already identified five sectors: agriculture, industry, tourism, energy, and waste to be the main sectors that could bring about this figure, and to maintain and improve our position in the World Economic Forum's International Competitive Index is the second target. We seek also to achieve 100% MID literacy by 2020 through the MID clubs and wide sensitization, and to be an internationally recognized knowledge hub for SD in the region or the Indian Ocean by 2020. Already, our two national universities are teaching up until master's level in sustainable development, and other universities that are setting base in Mauritius are now also teaching sustainable development. And in as far as equity is concerned, to improve our position in the Republic in the World Poverty Index, Mauritius devotes about 40% of its national budget every year through its social welfare program, which comprises of free education, free healthcare, free transportation to students, old age pension to every citizen above 60. So this has really brought up reduced the poverty level in the country. That is on since our independence, 1968. And we also seek to improve our current status in the Gini coefficient of income inequality. Now that we have the MID policy, strategy, and action plan, the MID PSAP, we are integrating it into ministries. I just some time ago had a meeting with all the focal points in the ministries, and work is ongoing. These are the focal points in all ministries in the Mauritius. Next slide, please. And these are the meeting with the permanent secretaries, because they all said we have to have the permanent secretaries on board as well. And we met them, and we explained to them what the plan is. And now, right now in Mauritius, budget preparation is on, and we are integrating whatever there is in the MID PSAP in the program-based budgeting of Mauritius. The minister will read the budget in a week's time, next Friday, in fact, 8th of November. The MID PSAP also contains the MID compliance part, which seeks to filter strategies, policies, and action, and establishes whether there are significant environmental intergenerational and social impacts. And it may be conducted when first considering a policy or a project or an action, and it will seek to show policymakers whether or not options are compatible with sustainable development. Next slide. Monitoring and evaluation is an important part, and the green economy workshop that we are having at the end of this month, there will be three experts. They are going to stay back for two more days to develop together with us the MID realization index, and also to look at the legal framework for sustainable development, which is catered for and advocated in the MID PSAP. The institutional for implementing the MID PSAP is as follows. There is a commission on MID at the Prime Minister's office, which has the following responsibilities: to coordinate and monitor the plan so as to ensure its timely implementation, to provide policy advice on SD to government, to advise government on and enforce MID compliance, and to manage the MID fund henceforth, so as it is in line with the MID PSAP. The Ministry of Environment will continue to collaborate. They were part of, together with us throughout the process. And there will be an MID strategic committee at the level of the Prime Minister's office still, which will advise the MID Commission on emerging sustainability and compliance issues. I don't have anything on my screen anymore. And the MID Strategic Committee, which will still be comprised of the private sector, public sector, and civil society, will also be there to incorporate the concerns of the private sector, civil society, and NGO into development issues. I'm told to speak slower, but I'm running out of time, so I'm a bit in a dilemma here. next slide, please. The implementing of the MIDP SAP has already started throughout the ministries. Ministries are very important because through policies, they can touch the whole country, including the private sector and civil society. Next slide, please. And all ministries are concerned with the MIDP SAP because all of them has got something to do, that has got something in the plan that concerns them. I'm not going to go through all of them because I'm running out of time. Next slide. So we have the Ministry of Land, Ministry of Environment, Ministry of Industry, Local Government, Fisheries, Education. Next slide. Social Security, Tourism, Civil Service, even the Ministry of Civil Service, which is an administrative ministry, has got a project that is specific to it. So I think I will stop here because I'm running out of time, and I will take your questions later. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mohamed. It's indeed a very rich program, and there's quite a bit of information that we certainly can learn from. And just for your benefit, I know that this presentation will be posted, and I'll give you the direct link to the website as soon as we're finished here. But continuing on the sharing of national experience, I would like to now give the floor to Ambassador Makrita Barrow. And by way of introduction, as you will know, the permanent mission of Kiribati only recently opened here in New York. Ambassador Barrow has the privilege of being the first permanent representative of her country. Prior to taking up this appointment, she was the relations manager in the Kiribati Education Improvement Program, supporting the Ministry of Education. But she has certainly had a very illustrious career in the public service in her government. But as well as in the region, I know that she's served as the Permanent Secretary for the Foreign Affairs and International Trade, Director of the Political and International Affairs Division within the Secretariat of the Pacific Islands Forum in Fiji, and Chief Secretary and Secretary of the Cabinet. She holds a Master's of Arts degree and a degree in Sociology and Administration. Ambassador Barrow will speak on climate change challenges facing Kiribati and practical measures that they have taken to address them. And I turn the floor over now to Her Excellency.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, fellow panelists, excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. I thank the organizers for the invitation to participate in this SIDS special panel discussion on strengthening the resilience of small island developing states within the context of sustainable development. The objective of this session this morning, as I understand it, is to discuss potential initiatives that can help with the strengthening of the SIDS abilities to address their vulnerability and structural challenges. Madam Chair, the special case of small island developing states for sustainable development and their unique and particular vulnerabilities is now well recognized and acknowledged by the international community, starting at Rio in 1992, reaffirmed in Barbados in 1994, and again in Mauritius in 2005, and more recently was reaffirmed in the Future We Want during the Rio Plus 20 deliberations. But recognition of vulnerability, Madam Chair, is not an end in itself. The real question for small island developing states, mine included, and for our regional and international organizations, is what do we do to address these vulnerabilities? The road from Rio in 92 to now, 21 years later in 2013, has been a long, winding, and uphill one. And Madam Chair, we cannot continue to sing the same vulnerable message. It is time for action. At the recent high-level segment of the 68th UNGA, my President, His Excellency Anote Tong, posed the question, how can we meaningfully talk of sustainable development without first addressing these key vulnerabilities in our countries? Small island developing states have been discussing this very issue in our different regions, starting in July in the Caribbean, followed by the Pacific SITS and NAMES regional meetings in Fiji and Seychelles, and then in Barbados for the final regional intersession in August this year. The outcome document from this interregional meeting is one which SITS will use as the basis for preparations for the landmark Samoa conference next year, and which will be tabled shortly before the second committee. Madam Chair, I particularly welcome this opportunity to share some thoughts from Kiribati at this special SITS event. My presentation today will address two aspects of the priorities addressed in the SITS outcome document, namely, the first and single most pressing challenge for us in Kiribati, and that is climate change. And secondly, how we are responding to this major overarching challenge that affects all other aspects of our sustainable development efforts. Madam Chair, climate change is the greatest threat to the livelihoods, security, and well-being of the peoples of our region, and one of the greatest challenges for the entire world. For us, it is a critical issue for the survival of our people. Because of this, Madam Chair, we continue to call with urgency on our development partners to assist in our efforts to deal with the impacts of climate change and sea level rise now being experienced in our countries and in our efforts to prepare our people for an uncertain future. The delivery of international adaptation finance, Madam Chair, and resources for adaptation are taking far too long to materialize. Much of the international work and funds that have been made available to us in Kiribati for climate adaptation are used for studies, for research, for consultancies, for institutional or more specifically individual capacity building, with some elements of adaptation programs on the ground. At any point in time in Kiribati, there would be at least 20 experts or consultants on climate change from regional and international institutions working with different ministries on various climate change reports. Then there are the students who descend upon us from various universities all over the world studying climate change and its impact on a nation and a people that may no longer be around for much longer. Then there are the media representatives, again from around the world. And these interests, Madam Chair, we welcome because it helps us develop empirical data that can substantiate and help us articulate our concerns to the rest of the world. It helps us focus global attention on our plight as a nation and as a people. But beyond that, we are just as vulnerable, even more so today, than when our first national communication report was completed and sent to the UNFCCC in 1999. We have to be the most studied, the most researched, and the most media-covered nation relating to climate change. We have volumes of the most glossy of reports on the impact of climate change and proposed adaptation measures. And seriously, Madam Chair, enough reports to build a bridge between New York and Kiribati. We could have just driven over. These reports, Madam Chair, were developed in a process of consultation with our people. So they have contributed, one, to the heightened level of the national anxiety pulse. Secondly, It has resulted, these many reports have resulted in raised expectations on the national government on what it can do to alleviate adverse effects of climate change. Thirdly, Madam Chair, these reports share the same fate. The recommended adaptation programs have remained just that, recommendations. For a lack of resources and adaptation funds that could be used for implementation, these adaptation funds have not materialized. A fourth point about these reports, Madam Chair, is that it emphasizes to our people that these changes, which our people have observed over recent times, is because of a larger phenomena, a result of activities that we have no control over and which will only get worse with time. And finally, Madam Chair, most of these reports tell us what we already know and are now experiencing nationwide, not only in my own country, but in other similar low-lying coral atolls like Tuvalu, the Republic of the Marshall Islands, Maldives, who are in the front line of the climate change crisis. What these reports have highlighted, which we already know, is that one, our sea levels are rising. For a nation where all except one of our islands lie not more than 1 meter above sea level, the highest point in Kiribati is 3 meters above sea level. This is frightening. It is even more frightening to know that it will only get worse, as the experts tell us. It also brings and highlights the fact that we already know that our coastlines are fast being eroded to the rise in sea level, and the more frequent, higher than normal tides that come in once a month, and the increased storm surges, and that this, again, will only get worse. With this realization, the national anxiety pulse rises even higher, especially when whole villages have had to be relocated. It also highlights the point that frequent, prolonged, intense disasters and extreme events are becoming a common phenomenon, and we all suffer at an unprecedented scale, putting a lot of pressure on families, on villages, and on already challenged national systems and the national economy. That these changes, Madam Chair, are posing a major threat to our supply of fresh water. The vast majority of our people draw water requirements from limited groundwater sources, which have increasingly become brackish and salty. That our traditional food crops grown in dugout pits are harder to grow now, and in some areas have had to be abandoned because of the greater salinity in the water. This is a major concern, Madam Chair. That climate change has resulted in higher sea temperatures and greater ocean acidification, threatening our coral reefs and the source of our sustenance, our coastal fisheries, which provides for our daily livelihood. In a nation where more than half of the population live a subsistence lifestyle, this is cause for great concern on food security. These reports have highlighted yet another area of concern, that we have no higher grounds to move up to as the sea level rises, and that our limited resources, insufficient technical and institutional capacity, grossly limit our adaptive capacity to address these challenges. Madam Chair, funds allocated for adaptation are rarely available or hard to access, although adaptation should be given equal importance to mitigation and should proceed in tandem with each other. Madam Chair, this is the reality that our people live with. The families, the women and children, and the men, young and old, living on all our 33 islands. This is the uncertain future, the insecurity, the anxieties, the sense of helplessness, and the grave concerns our people face today about the real changes that are now affecting them, caused by events happening elsewhere beyond their control and beyond our control. Madam Chair, climate change is posing urgent security challenges for countries like mine. We are in the front line of all this. Climate change is happening now for us. It is already causing loss of territory, severe coastal erosion, involuntary displacement of communities, decrease in food and water security, and more importantly, it has become a survival issue. These impacts are putting enormous pressure on domestic institutions, the national budget, the families, the sense of well-being of the people, and these will continue to grow worse over time and over the foreseeable future. So what are we doing as a nation about this? We have mainstreamed climate change and our responses into our national planning and development framework. We have embarked on a program of mangrove planting on coastlines to help protect and alleviate erosion to our coastal areas. Indeed, the UN Secretary General himself planted a whole section of these mangrove plants during his recent visit to Kiribati in 2011. We are building seawalls to protect infrastructure, roads, and public areas, and are encouraging communities to build seawalls to protect their villages, providing the labor while government provides machinery and materials. But resources are finite, Madam Chair. Do we keep building seawalls to protect our people's homes? Do we keep diverting resources from other equally pressing priorities, such as health and education programs? Madam Chair, adaptation is important, as it provides us with some short-term solutions to help cope with the changes brought about by climate change. But how can we adapt to the already brackish and increasingly salty water from our ground wells, which is the major source of drinking water for the majority of our people? Scientific evidence, Madam Chair, projects that our islands will no longer be able to sustain life in the not-too-distant future. We must prepare our people for this eventuality and the eventual need to relocate. Madam Chair, government has taken a policy position that it would be irresponsible to acknowledge this reality and not do anything to prepare our community for eventual migration in circumstances that permit them to migrate with dignity. That said, we have emphasized to our people that relocation will always be viewed and as an option of last resort. We have bought land offshore. To prepare our people, government has placed a major focus on education, including vocational and technical education. We have embarked on a major program of overhauling our whole entire education system in line with government's policy on relocation and migration with dignity. We have facilitated overseas employment and permanent emigration opportunities for our people. We have explored long-term survivability and self-reliance options that ensure sustainability of nationhood, culture, and the identity of the Kiribati. We are looking at various options available to a disappearing state. The legalities, the precedents, and the modalities, and there are not too many precedents to draw from. We have embarked on the nationwide community consultation program to emphasize to our people and to sensitize our people on the issues and the challenges of climate change and the importance of education and acquiring marketable skills. Madam Chair, we can only do so much. We cannot do it alone. We thank our partners who have assisted us thus far, but much, much more needs to be done. Because of our climate change, our future as a nation and as a people, as well as so many others within the UN family of nations, is uncertain. We present a whole new security challenge for this family of nations. We also bring a whole new meaning to human rights and the right to a secure future. What secure future can we really talk about for the people in Kiribati? Climate change has raised a new dimension of human rights, the right to clean drinking water, the right to education, and the right to survive. It has also brought a new dimension to the definition of the word refugee. Madam Chair, we are the early warning system. The UN and the international community must take heed of what is happening in our countries, not only in Kiribati, but in other similar low-lying countries, Tuvalu, Marshalls, and in the Maldives. For what is happening in our countries is also happening in other small island developing states, in other parts of the globe, although not at the nationwide scale that we are facing. Most of the world's large cities are on coastal low-lying areas, and they too will eventually face these same security challenges down the line. The scope of the problem will only increase with time, and the time to act is now. As our challenges grow in magnitude, we have sadly observed the almost clinical way these challenges are being addressed, that it is best left to the UNFCCC process. Others say that is a second committee matter. Others say that is addressed in resolution number such and such. That is not UN language. Some say it was not in the text last year of a resolution. It reminds me, Madam Chair, of being in surgery, lying on the surgery table with doctors above you talking as if you were not there, as if the patient is already dead. This is how our people are feeling. As we prepare for the third international conference on SIDS in 2014 in Samoa, the small island developing states, Madam Chair, have called for genuine and durable partnerships that is people-centered, that is based on mutual trust, respect, and accountability. As we also prepare for COP19, I urge all delegations to focus on the urgent need to address the security implications of climate change, including violation of territorial integrity, existential threat, more frequent and severe climate-related disasters, threats to water and food security, increased natural resource scarcity, and forced displacement, and the human dimensions of climate change, including, where necessary, initiatives for preparing communities for relocation. Madam Chair, business as usual cannot be the way forward. Indeed, a paradigm shift is required, starting within our own nations and moving out to our regional and international processes, including in the UN and its agencies. We need to ask ourselves serious questions. For instance, why are the graduating countries from the LDC, why are all except one from the small island developing states? Why? If we have indeed been saying for 21 years that they are the most vulnerable nations, Why are they being allowed to graduate? How are we, or indeed, are we serving our member nations? Have we adjusted to ensure our programs are addressing the changing challenges facing our member countries? We need to do some more thinking, thinking outside of the box, focusing on innovative, integrated, tangible, targeted, and implementable action on the ground that can have a positive impact on those who we are here to represent, our people. Madam Chair, I would like to request that I share with the panel and with the excellencies this morning a short audio-visual presentation that gives the human face and the people-centered background to this presentation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm Nepenin Maori, and welcome to the beautiful islands of Kiribati. This is Naomi.
Maori.
We would like to bring you greetings on this special day in the history of Kiribati. We would also like to show you something of our beloved country.
Kam na penini Maori, and welcome to Kiribati, the first country in the world to greet the new dawn. Kiribati became a member of the UN family of nations in 1999. And by our new consular presence, we are now able to be a more visible participant at the center of world events. Our ancestors were great sea navigators, and over past centuries, they made many long sea voyages from various parts of the Pacific. The more recent migrations were from Polynesia. Our 33 tiny atolls are spread across 3.5 million square kilometres in the Central Pacific. It's half the size of Australia. We also have the second largest EEZ, or fishing zone, in the world. Surrounded by this huge ocean, it is inevitable that fish plays an important part in our lives. Having so little land space, it's also our main source of protein. Revenue from foreign fishing licenses is also one of the major sources of income for our small economy. In 2009, this totaled 29.5 million. Our young men are born fishermen, and the government is seeking to increase overseas employment opportunities for trained fishermen on vessels fishing our waters. In Kiribati, we have two forms of governance. The Westminster system of democracy was passed on from the British when we gained independence in 1979. In our villages and communities, we also have our traditional system of local government, where each family is represented in the maniapa, or meeting house. The elderly have always held a special place in our culture. Many of them are guardians of traditional knowledge and wisdom. Because of limited human impact, our outer islands continue to offer natural beauty and pristine environmental conditions.
One, two, three.
Special pride of place goes to our being custodian to the Phoenix Islands Protected Area, Pipa. This very special location is home to many fish and bird species. Some are rare and unique to this region. In 2010, Pipa was declared a UNESCO World Heritage Park, and its eventual implementation will be Kiribati's gift to the world. Just under half of our 110,000 people continue to live an outer-island lifestyle, a lifestyle based on subsistence fishing and food gathering. However, even here in these remote places, the cash economy is starting to gain a foothold. With a population of more than 55,000, South Tarawa is the administrative and commercial center of our country. The challenges we face here are to do with overpopulation, high youth unemployment, and major pressure on the few resources available. Apart from encouraging economic development, the government's response is to seek the support and assistance of our friends and donor partners to invest in a range of activities. Basic education is one priority. Another priority is in the area of vocational education, which will better prepare our people for employment opportunities, both locally and in the international labor market. We call this Migration with Dignity. One continuing success story is the training of local seamen to serve on vessels overseas. Our seafarers have a top international reputation, and in 2009, their remittances totaled $11.6 million. Our country is having to deal with many of the challenges which face small island developing nations. If that wasn't enough, we now face another new and dangerous challenge.
Climate change is no doubt the greatest moral challenge of the 21st century.
As any Kiribati thinking, this is our home. This is our land. This is where we're born. And this is where we will die. And but a natural death is what we are expecting. But the kids are worrying. It's in their mind, and it's becoming part of their life, this worry of where would they be next year, the day after, or 15 years from now. It's a worry. It's big, too much to us.
Already, communities have had to relocate, and the latest reputable science tells us that the threat to our fragile waterlands from sea level rise and human-induced pollution is now much more immediate. Without fresh water, there can be no life. However, many years before we heard about climate change, one of our composers had predicted such a happening. The song tells of a frigate bird flying the ocean in search of food for her young. When she returns, she finds that her homeland has disappeared beneath the waves. Yes, climate change isn't just about science and development. It's about people, it's about people, it's about people. It's about the survival of a unique and vibrant culture. But above all, it's about the young, our children and their children. We cannot handle this issue alone. We call on the world leaderships to rise above their domestic concerns. We call on the finest minds of the world to assist. In the case of Kiribati, so much is at stake. Kambesa Ndaba, thank you.
We would like to thank you for your attention and for being a good friend of Kiribati. As we can see, we face a very uncertain future. Nomi, do you have a special wish you'd like to share with us?
Yes, I want to grow up and be safe and happy in Kiribati.
Good girl.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Barrow, for that very important message that you have delivered to us. We will now be hearing from Mr. Peter Allam. Mr. Allam is the Assistant Director in the IMF Strategy, Policy and Review Department, where he currently provides leadership in the design and monitoring of the IMF's policy engagement with small state members. In this role, he has overseen a March 2013 report to the IMF Executive Board on fund engagement with small states. He has participated in meetings with small island developing states from the Caribbean and Pacific and has presented at the October 2013 meeting of the Small States Forum in Washington, D.C. Mr. Allam has more than 20 years' experience in the IMF. Over the past decade, much of his work has been with African countries, including as resident representative in Uganda from 2004 to 2006. He's also had extensive experience working with countries in the Middle East, Central Asia, and Latin America. Prior to joining the IMF, Mr. Allam was an economist in the United Kingdom's Department of Trade and Industry, the UK's Treasury, and in the British Embassy in Washington, D.C. Mr. Allam, you have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, ambassadors, fellow panelists, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to appear before you on this panel on a very important issue. The IMF is keenly aware that small states face a different and more challenging path towards economic development than their larger peers. And for this reason, our engagement with these states is carefully tailored. And for some small states, they benefit from the fund's most concessional lending terms. As a member of the UN organizations, we welcome very much the efforts to highlight the special circumstances of small states through the Barbados Program of Action and the Mauritius Strategy. And indeed, although this program of action was launched nearly two decades ago, its goals remain critical today, as we've seen from this last presentation. Next slide, please. I'd like to focus my presentation today on the broad macroeconomic characteristics of vulnerability and resilience for small states, rather than on the individual challenges facing individual countries. When I look at the Barbados and the Mauritius reports, macroeconomics are not the focus of these documents, and attention is rightly on issues such as environment, transport and communications, power supplies, culture and health. And these are indeed critical priorities for small states. At the same time, the resources required to deliver these goals need to be part of a coherent macroeconomic framework, and this framework itself needs to be resilient to shocks. So I'll cover today three broad topics in my presentation. First, how we see the recent macroeconomic performance of small states going over the last few decades. Second, how the IMF in its engagement with small states tailors this work and our facilities and policies. And last, on the specific issue of macroeconomic resilience, how can we work with SIDS members to strengthen their resilience? Let me start with the first theme, what we know about the macroeconomic performance of small states. This is something that we examined in detail in March this year in a report to our executive board, a meeting of our executive board. We prepared three reports for this review, all of which are available on the IMF's external website. One was on the global situation and challenges facing small states, and we had two complementary reports on the regional challenges facing the Caribbean and the Pacific. Our focus on small states in this study was on countries with populations of less than 1.5 million. And I'm aware that this categorization is slightly different from the UN SIDS category. So, for example, we don't include Jamaica, which is a SIDS country, but we do include Bhutan. But if you look at the two sets of countries, the correspondence is so close that I think you can take our findings in respect of small states as being very much typical of the SIDS community. And so when I refer to small states today in my presentation, I'm effectively talking about the same SIDS community. So on the slide that we have here, first our study found some relatively good news for the average of small states, and I should say this is the average. I mean, of course, there's a lot of divergence within the SIDS community. But if you look at them on the whole, you find that per capita income levels in 2012 and their human development rating as measured by the UN is slightly higher on average than for larger developing country peers, shown in green in this slide. Next slide, please. But on the other hand, there are some less favorable news. The trend seems to have changed over the past decade. And so if you look at the performance during the 1990s, small states were actually growing considerably faster than their larger peers. But if you look at the performance over the most recent decade, starting in 2000, that situation has changed. The pace of growth for small states has dropped off, and quite dramatically in the Caribbean, but also in the Pacific region, whereas for larger countries, you're seeing much faster growth than you saw in the preceding decade. And that is passing through to human development indicators, so that larger states are now seeing much faster improvement in their development indicators and living standards than small states, leaving them in a position of relative stagnation. Next slide, please. For small states, sluggish growth is also combined with greater macroeconomic volatility. We looked at various measures of macroeconomic performance, including per capita income growth rates, budget balances, external current account balances, and aid receipts. And for the small states shown in orange here, the volatility of those macroeconomic variables is much larger than those for the larger states shown in green. And this difference in volatility is particularly marked for the micro states with populations of under 200,000. Next slide, please. Part of this economic volatility faced by the microstates, shown here in blue in this chart, is their disproportionate vulnerability to natural disasters. This slide measures the average cost to the countries of a natural disaster on an average base each year in terms of the shares of GDP. This greater vulnerability comes from the limited diversification of the economic production and trade in small states, and also their limited geographic size distribution. So for a large country like the US, you could have an earthquake in one part, say California, but 99% of the economy is unaffected, whereas if an earthquake hits, for example, Haiti, the result is devastating. For small states with undiversified production bases, they're also very subject to industry-specific shocks. So if you have a harvest failure, or a fall in the global price of a key export commodity, that has pervasive impact on the economy. Next slide, please. The IMF also tracks on an annual basis the vulnerability of low-income countries to growth downturns, and we produce an annual report on this. The most recent version, published in September, included a detailed look at the situation of small states. as well as fragile states, oil exporters, and the residual economic category. And we found that small states have been much less successful than their larger peers in rebuilding buffers, fiscal and external buffers, after the 2008-2009 global recession. And in this chart, the orange blocks represent small states. The left-hand left-hand chart panel is gross international reserves, international reserve coverage in terms of months of imports, less than 4 months of import cover, whereas for larger states, it's more than five. Fiscal deficits, 2% for small states, and less than 1.5% for larger countries. So that when a shock hits these countries, small states have a smaller buffer with which to respond. Next slide, please. Our experience or our econometric analysis suggests that countries with small economic buffers are more likely to be tipped into a recession by a new economic shock. And we, based on the size of the buffers available and the nature of the economies, we categorize countries are at high, medium, or low risk of a growth recession in the period ahead. The red bar, the red elements of each of these blocks represents high-risk countries. The top panel represents all low-income countries, excluding fragile states, small states, and oil exporters. And you'll see that only a small fraction of these countries are vulnerable to growth downturns. And there was a marked pickup in 2009 at the time of the start of the global economic crisis. But that vulnerability for the the low-income country community has abated over the last 4 years to the point where vulnerabilities are now much reduced. And this comes from the well-publicized fact that many low-income countries are actually among the fastest-growing countries in the world at the moment, including in sub-Saharan Africa. The lower part of the panel here is the comparative charts for small states across the world. And you'll see that many more of these are classified by the IMF as at high risk of a growth downturn as a result of shocks. This vulnerability picked up, you'll see, in 2008-09 at the start of the global economic crisis, but it's remained at very high levels in recent years, reflecting the much slower growth of those countries. Next slide, please. To recap then, we find that small states have been growing more slowly than their larger peers for at least a decade. They're subject to greater macroeconomic volatility, and they still face very elevated risks of slowing growth in the event of external shocks. A natural question that arises is, what is the root cause of this less favorable situation? Why is their position now worse than it was a decade or two ago? And this is something that we don't fully understand. We've got some ideas, but we don't have all of the answers yet. One possibility is that the global economy has become less favorable to small states than it was a decade or two ago. We all know that global supply chains have become a new way of doing economic business, and it may be that larger countries are much better placed to participate in the production of components which then feed into a global supply chain. It may also be, and it's certainly the case for some small states, that they benefited from trade preferences for commodities such as sugar, cotton, a decade or more ago, and those trade preferences have diminished over time. It may also be that larger states, having experienced very weak growth in the 1980s and 1990s, were forced to undertake quite dramatic macroeconomic stabilization and reform initiatives in many cases. And it's possible that some small states lag behind this process and are now bearing the cost of that. There are many other explanations, and these are likely to vary across countries, and it's an area in which we intend to do more economic analysis in the period ahead. Next slide, please. What is clear in our work is that one can't speak of a SIDS community as a homogeneous homogeneous group of countries. There are important differences, for example, between the Caribbean and Pacific Island small states, as indicated in this chart here. The first column compares per capita income levels, and you'll see that for the Caribbean, per capita incomes are almost three times higher than for Pacific Island countries. And their growth rate is also considerably stronger than for the Pacific Island countries in the second column. That said, they've also seen the largest slowdown in economic growth. The Caribbean was doing quite well region in the 1990s, but in the 2000s, its growth rate has slowed dramatically, whereas for the Pacific Island countries, this slow, sluggish rate of growth in the 2000s is something that's not that much different from the 1990s. When you look at overseas development assistance received by small states, the Pacific Island countries get much larger amounts than the Caribbean, which is a benefit on one hand, but also they're very much dependent on these flows, and so volatility, unpredictability in aid flows can be a source of considerable distress. And the last column compares public debt levels. Perhaps because of the overseas development assistance, Pacific Islands have a relatively modest level of public debt, whereas Caribbean islands have three times the level. And it's quite problematic in many countries. Next slide, please. In fact, this chart highlights the level of public debt problems for the Caribbean. The red bar across the center reflects the or represents the average public debt ratio for Latin American and Caribbean countries, and it averages something less than 40% of GDP, which in the current global context is relatively favorable. The blue bars represent a group of Caribbean countries, and you'll see that many of those have much, much higher levels of public debt, in many cases exceeding, doubling the average for the broader continent. And of the top six countries in this chart, four were forced to seek debt restructuring from their creditors over the past decade, signifying the extent of the debt problems that they face. Let me now move on to how the IMF works with small states in our engagement. Next slide, please. One of the primary benefits of IMF membership is access to relatively low-cost financing to help weather external shocks. And we have a range of facilities which can provide either one-off disbursements to help weather sudden shocks or program-based lending to help implementation of adjustment policies over longer periods ranging from 1 to 4 years. Over the past decade, nine small states have accessed one-off loans, in some cases on multiple occasions, and 10 countries have obtained program-based financing, again, with some of those coming back for repeated loans. While this grouping is less than half of the overall small states membership, not all countries borrow from the fund, and that's true for SIDS as well as it is for larger countries. The take-up of IMF financing tends to reflect the particular financing needs of small states. So funding requests have been more common from Caribbean small states where debt burdens are highest. And small states with the highest per capita income levels have also been less likely to borrow from the IMF. Next slide, please. Next slide again. I think we're missing a slide. Next one. Okay, let's stop there. Apart from the financing on very favorable terms that the general membership receives, the IMF has a pool of concessional resources available to low-income countries. And indeed, given the strains imposed by the global recession at the moment, the interest rate on these loans is currently set at a zero rate. These concessional loans are normally restricted to countries with a per capita income of less than $2,500 per capita, but eligibility for small states has been increased to a higher income level of $3,600. And starting this year with a new reform, we extended eligibility to the group of microstates with populations of less than 200,000 to an income level of over $7,000. As a result of these special windows for small and micro states, 14 members are available, 14 SIDS members are available for concessional resources that would not otherwise be available. Next slide, please. That's it. A second major contribution that the IMF provides to our members is technical assistance. Our staff and contractual experts provide assistance on a wide range of macroeconomic issues, including tax administration and policies, budget design and implementation, financial supervision and regulation, and data compilation. The cost of TA provision to small states is, of course, a relatively small part of our overall TA budget, but spending on a per capita basis is much higher than for larger countries. Could you skip forward to the next slide, please, I think? Yeah, just stay there for the moment. So the top block here is per capita income on technical assistance per population. The orange is for the SIDS and the green is for the larger countries. We provide assistance to our members increasingly through regional technical assistance centres, and these feature resident experts based in one country providing targeted assistance to that country as well as to a regional cluster of neighbouring states. The priorities for these centres are established annually through a governance structure that includes regional officials, ministers of finance, governors of central bank. And as a result of this regional participation, this model is very effective in making TA, technical assistance, responsive to the needs of our member countries. And reflecting that, we have been able to benefit from transfers, subsidies from other development agencies to partly finance the costs of running these centres. For the SIDS countries, two regional technical assistance centres are particularly important, that in the Pacific, based in Fiji, and in the Caribbean, based in Barbados. And the bottom two blocks in this chart reflect the person years of technical assistance spent by these various, or delivered by these various technical assistance centres. This is time in terms of people in the field, in the ministries, conducting discussions, providing assistance, rather than administrative time in the various headquarters. As you'll see for the Pacific Technical Assistance Centre on the left, there's been a steady upward increase in the delivery of technical assistance since the centre was launched back in 2002. For the Caribbean region, the delivery of technical assistance has been more varied, but that has reflected the needs of the region, so that there was a marked increase in the 2009-2011 period at the start of the global financial crisis, when the recession in the United States had quite dramatic spillovers for the Caribbean countries. Thank you. Next slide. The IMF has also helped a number of small states tackle their public debt burdens where these have become unsustainable. Three have benefited from international debt relief from the IMF under our MDRI process, complementing international debt relief under the HIPC process. Five middle-income small states who were ineligible for HIPC and MDRI debt relief benefited from debt restructuring operations over the past decade. And in three of those cases, the operation was supported by a lending arrangement from the IMF. And in the other two cases, the IMF provided important advice on the macroeconomic implications of the debt reduction operations that they were taking forwards. Next slide, please. In addition to our roles in providing financing and technical assistance, the IMF is an important advisory institution for our members' countries on macroeconomic issues. And in preparing and delivering this advice, we are very alert to the fact that the SIDS community have very different needs and characteristics to large states. And to help attune our staff to these issues and these differences, we're currently preparing a small states guidance note, which we will finalize before the end of the year. The goal here is to, as you know, perhaps know, the IMF economists tend to move from country to country. After a three-year assignment on one country, they move on to another country. And so an economist who has worked, for example, on China, who then moves to work on Kiribati, will find a very different situation confronting them. And so this guidance note will give them a primer on the sort of issues that they'll need to brush up on as they start their new assignment. In addition to this guidance note, our economists are working on a range of analytical work which is relevant to SIDS. And so, for example, in the Small States Forum, in the October annual meetings of the IMF and the World Bank, our Fiscal Affairs Department presented on the options for using fiscal rules in a small state setting. We've also discussed with our member SIDS countries the challenges in terms of encouraging growth performance, both in a high-level Caribbean forum last month hosted by the government of Bahamas, and we'll be holding a similar conference in November hosted by the government of Vanuatu, focused on how to raise growth in the Pacific region. Next chart, please. Turning to the third topic of how to build resilience, this chart, I think, highlights some of the elements that need to be considered. On the left-hand block, the shocks are rolling in. SIDS face different shocks depending on where they are and their different exposure. And the resilience to that, to those shocks, in many cases you can't do much about the nature of the shocks. However, you can prepare and respond, mitigation and response. And there are two elements of that. One is the nature and the quality, the speediness, etc., of the domestic policy response by the member countries. That's the block up at the top in the chart here. The other is the quality of the international support that they receive from the global community and from international financial institutions, and that's the bottom block. And hopefully with those two elements coming together, you see a faster recovery than would otherwise have occurred, and a better outcome in terms of living standards and development gains. Next slide, please. Small states can strengthen their response, their resilience to shocks in a number of ways. First of all, they can make proactive investments to mitigate risks. And we heard in the preceding sobering presentation of the challenges facing Kiribati in terms of building seawalls and other protective infrastructure. And in advising governments on fiscal frameworks, it's very important that we ensure that adequate fiscal space is available to cover the costs of these investments. It's also important that the financing be available to cover these costs, and we can work with members to identify sources of development assistance and help them strengthen the case for seeking that financing. In cases where external development assistance is not available, in some cases we can work with governments on multi-year efforts to build domestic revenue mobilization, particularly in middle-income countries which have a potential revenue base that can cover infrastructure needs. Technical assistance from the IMF on revenue administration and tax policy may be part of what is needed to build this revenue. Next slide, please. Next slide again. With shallow financial systems and a small savings pool, many SIDs have vulnerable vulnerable citizens with little protection against the loss of property and livelihoods that can come with natural disasters and other shocks. And public safety nets in these cases can provide important relief. The IMF, working with our partners, including the World Bank and other regional development banks, have in the past provided a range of advice on how to design and launch and finance public safety nets. It's important for affordability that these be targeted, They also need to be designed in a way that they can be responsive so that assistance can be ramped up quickly in the event of shocks. Next slide, please. Fiscal and debt frameworks also need to be designed to foster resilience to shocks. First step is to look at the potential cost to the budget of shocks and consider how these can be accommodated. Sovereign insurance options are not available now, and these provide payouts in the event of adverse climatic events. However, for participating countries, these are still relatively costly and cannot reasonably cover the full extent of risks that countries face, and so self-insurance is more typically adopted. For repeated relatively small shocks, we can work with countries to ensure that contingency provision is provided in the budget to finance shocks. However, for larger once-every-decade shocks, say, a government will typically need to either run down cash balances or borrow to finance recovery-related spending. And this points to the benefits of a generally conservative approach to the size of fiscal deficits and public debt levels. This approach would ensure that countries have a buffer to accommodate additional debt-financed spending in the event of shocks. Consideration also needs to be given to how to bring fiscal performance back to the former conservative path after the impact of the shock recedes. Where development financing is used to weather shocks, budget transparency and accountability should also be a goal so that development partners have the assurances that they need for the domestic audience, including parliaments, that development funding is well used. Next slide, please. Consideration also needs to be given to the balance of payments impact of shocks. These typically result in a decline in foreign currency inflows or may require additional foreign currency expenditures to pay for needed imports. Countries have access to IMF financing in the event of external shocks and may also be able to tap other official and private funding sources. However, external financing to cover the full scale of a shock may not always be available, and so ample holdings of international reserves can provide a further useful and complementary buffer. Exchange rate adjustment may also be appropriate in the event of lasting shocks to the balance of payments position. However, given the large import needs of small states, currency flexibility is also needed. Currency flexibility may often be needed. But this needs to be managed carefully to avoid triggering destabilizing inflation. So to conclude, Madam Chair, I'd like to emphasize several of my points. Our analysis underlines that small states continue to face very real macroeconomic challenges. And I think this underlines the importance of today's event, the UN's focus on small states, and the upcoming conference next year in Samoa. Second, overcoming these macroeconomic challenges will require determined efforts, both by the small states themselves, but also from the international community. Third, in looking at the appropriate macroeconomic policies to foster and sustain resilience, there are both similarities across small states, common needs, common challenges, but there are also variations in the circumstances and the challenges that they face. In general, achieving sustained improvements in economic growth is a universal priority. However, managing excessive public debt burdens is something that for the Caribbean states is a particular challenge. And last, let me underline that the IMF is taking deliberate steps to enhance the effectiveness of our engagement with SIDS, taking their special diverse needs into account. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Allen, for that very useful presentation on the macroeconomic aspects of SIDS vulnerabilities and options and measures that may be taken into account in addressing resilience. We will now have the pleasure of hearing from Dr. José Regidor. Dr. Regidor is director of the University of Las Palmas de Gran Canaria, Spain, and member of the Board of Trustees of the University Consortium of Small Island States. He is a renowned scholar in biology, cell biology, and medicine, having served on the faculty of prestigious universities, including the College of Las Palmas, Boston University, the University of Granada, College of Las Palmas, and the University of Copenhagen. He's an honorary professor of St. Petersburg University of Water Communications and an honorary member of the Medical School of Las Palmas and member of the Canary Academy of Science. He has been appointed as member of the Royal Academy of Medicine and most recently as president of the Sectoral Commission of Communication with the CRU, which is the Conferencia de Rectores de las Universidades Españolas. He's the founder and patron of the Fundación Universitaria de Las Palmas. Dr. Regidor will be presenting on the University Consortium of Small Island States, whose member universities include SIDS National and Regional Universities. He will share with us information on the launch of a joint master's program on sustainable development of SIDS, which is a project of the DESA that is being financed by the government of Spain. He will also share his vision of future prospects for partnership with University Consortium. Thank you very much. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, distinguished representatives, ladies and gentlemen. Permítanme, como español y...
May I, as a Spaniard and as a patron of the Cervantes Institute, may I use my mother tongue? It's a language used by many of us the world over. The next slide, please. The objective of my presentation is to speak of a matter which has been of concern to us in the small island developing states, and that is the interaction and partnerships among SIDS and for SIDS. And in this case, the example of the University Consortium of Small Island States is something that we want to see as a practical method for achieving this partnership. Now, why the project of the University Consortium of Small Island States? Ms. Barro in this hall has already said that we've had many reports already, but now is the time to act. And it's precisely for this reason that we decided to consider how we can act within the small island developing states. And this is one type of action. It's one that has already been set underway. Now, why the University of Las Canarias? Because we're not a small island ourselves, we belong to Spain, but it should be recalled that the Kingdom of Spain is the main donor in this initiative. I'm very pleased to see the representative of Spain here, and I do hope we'll have continued support for this project because it's very important to all of us. And the second reason is that the University of Las Palmas of Gran Canaria has a number of capacities, important capacities, for all of the islands that are members of this consortium. Next slide. May I quickly introduce our university to you? First of all, we'd like to tell you where we are in the world. Europeans are well aware of where the Canary Islands are because every year we have about 12,000 tourists that visit us. We have 2 million inhabitants. We are in the Atlantic, and we are volcanic islands. There's the Portuguese Azores, Canarias, and to the south of us, the Cabo Verde Islands. We have an archipelago of 7 small islands, very close to the African continent. You can see on the image Gran Canaria is at the center of the archipelago, you can see on the slide. Next slide, please. The city of Las Palmas of Gran Canaria is on the northern part of the island on an isthmus, and that is exactly where the university is. The university bears the name of the capital of the island. It's a university that has different campuses. We have 25,000 students, 1,550 professors and researchers, 745 administrative personnel, and 25 academic centers. One of our main strengths is our virtual campus, a center of e-learning, where we have a number of facilities that are being used for the initiative that we have in this consortium, that is to give technological support for the projects that we're developing. We also have a number of master's courses and doctorates, a doctorate in oceanography, master's in sustainable fisheries, master's and doctorate in aquaculture, master and doctorate in coastal management, a master in sustainable tourism development, and a master's in integrated development of tourist destinations. As you can see, these are all fundamental subjects related to our concerns here in this hall. We have 166 research and development groups. We have 7 research institutes. They're multidisciplinary. They work for sustainable economic development and tourism. There's one institute for innovation in communications, and there's an institute for oceanography and for climate change. Our university also has a scientific and technological park with a number of headquarters. There's a marine scientific and technical park in particular, and a basic part of our work on fish pathology and aquaculture is done there, a research on oceanographic problems. And we have a microalgae data bank also, which serves as an important reference. Our university is a very committed one. We have UNESCO chairs, a UNESCO chair on research planning and development of local health systems. We have a UNESCO chair on computer sciences and information technologies. And that is basically for the area of Africa, which is closest to us. There is a UNESCO chair on environmental management and marine resources in coastal areas, a UNESCO chair on tourism planning and sustainable development, and a UNESCO chair on human rights and democracy. As you can understand, all of this is in line with what we view as our work for the small island states. In addition, this university is part of a number of networks of universities. There's the European Association of Universities. There's the Unamuno group. These are universities that are outside the European Union, the Portuguese islands, the French islands, and the Caribbean territories are included, the French-speaking, the French ones, and, of course, the Canaries. The Compostela group is a multidisciplinary group, basically European. AFRIMAR is an African and Canary group, and it works on coastal areas and port issues, port-related issues. RUNDIA is an inter-university network of on child necessities and rights. In Senegal, for example, we're working for children that have cardiological problems. They can get care in our hospital and then then go back home. And, of course, there's the University Consortium of Small Island States, and the RETI network created in Corsica. And it includes islands from virtually the world over. Our university has well-defined social responsibilities. There, you can see a list of the countries where we're carrying out many projects and where we're actively working. Now, as far as the product, there's a master's in sciences on sustainable development for small island states. The universities that participate in this master's program are the University of the West Indies. It's the coordinator. Professor David Smith is in this hall, as a matter of fact, and I would like to greet him and express thanks for the long conversations that we've been able to have here in New York. There's also the University of the South Pacific, the University of Mauritius, the University of Seychelles, and the University of Malta, and the University of Las Palmas, Gran Canaria. And I've already told you about its participation. Every university has a portion of the work. We've distributed the work among us. And each university deals with a specific issue. It produces materials. The University of Las Palmas is assigned sustainable fisheries as its topic of work. This is all difficult work. We can't say it's easy. It's difficult. This is work that's moving more slowly than we would have liked. But it is moving forward. So creating something which is making progress in the midst of many difficulties is something that makes us optimistic. And we're optimistic that more universities can be incorporated eventually into this project. So this is why we've created the project. This is why we're here. This is why we say that small islands, we the small islands, can unite, we can work together, we can create our own programs. And as the representative of the Pacific said, we do have to act. And one way of acting is undoubtedly by empowering our people with education, with appropriate education, and giving them all the possibilities so that we ourselves can create our own future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rahidor, for your presentation on a concrete example of SITSIT's partnership and something that has the potential to have very wide impact for SIDS as they continue to develop their resilience. And this one is focused on the people empowerment. I will not take up too much time because I'd like to hear from the delegations who are present here the questions, responses, and comments to the presentations we have had. I would like to open the floor for those comments. Thank you. I'd like to give the floor to Ambassador Pedro Luis Pedroso, Director of the Division for Multilateral Affairs, Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Republic of Cuba.
Buenos días y gracias, embajador.
Thank you, Ambassador, and a good day to everyone. First of all, we want to express our thanks to all the presenters for their very interesting statements. I was particularly moved by the statement made by the distinguished Ambassador of Kiribati. I think that presentation, as well as the film, really clearly illustrate the situation, not only in Kiribati, but in most small island states. I was thinking, when I was watching the documentary, that yes, it's very moving, but it's not enough to be moved. We have to progress from that threshold of being moved to action, as you said, and to see how the United Nations can cooperate and work together with the small island states to help them overcome all these difficult circumstances. I also come from a small island state. Maybe not as small as the Pacific Islands, but a small island nonetheless, which has empowered its people with education, with health. And so our experience shows us that that's not enough. It's not enough for us to empower our people with health care and education. It's important, and it's a very basic first step, but it doesn't suffice. There's an environment as well, an international environment that often determines what the small island states are actually able to do. It's not only a question of climate vulnerability. It's not just the fact that ecosystems are fragile. That in itself would be enough. But we also have economic vulnerability as a result of geographical dispersion, as a result of the small size of our countries, so it's not possible for us to develop economies of scale. And there are other vulnerabilities as well. Some of our countries, and we could mention some in the Caribbean, have managed very well to have their domestic gross income grow. But perhaps some are penalized because many of our countries in the Caribbean that are middle-income countries are being increasingly excluded from official development assistance flows. So above and beyond all of the vulnerabilities, there is sometimes a penalty to be paid for a certain level of development. And sometimes levels of growth decline, as they do everywhere in Latin America and the Caribbean, which is the region that I can talk about the most. Flows of investment are also on decline. And when you look at preferential systems, also preferences for the small island states are increasingly restricted. So we'd have to take a look at what's happening with the CEPI system. More and more conditionalities are being imposed on trade agreements that were initially established to favor the small states, not just the small island states, but the least developed states in Latin America and Asia and elsewhere. So that's why I'm saying it's not enough to think about what governments ourselves can do. We also have to consider the prevailing international environment and the conditions that exist in that international environment. When I was listening to the presentation by the representative of the International Monetary Fund, there was one point, I don't remember exactly what slide it was on, but there was a point on security and governability. And mention was made of civil unrest or something like lack of trust in governments as being a characteristic in small island developing states. I'm not sure. I didn't quite understand that slide. But I think that the small island states, compared to other states, can set an example of civil stability and governability. That is the case in the Caribbean. I think it's also the case in the Pacific. I don't think ingovernability is a trait of island states. So I didn't quite understand the meaning of that slide. Mention's also been made of how we can bring a budget back on track after a shock. Now, I wonder how a small remote island in the Pacific, after a tsunami, for example, or after a tropical storm, a severe tropical storm, can bring its budget into order. It's much more complicated than that. When a budget depends on fishing exports, and obviously fishing exports were affected by a consequence of a tsunami or of a typhoon or of a hurricane, or when the economy depends on tourism, and tourism was destroyed as a result of a natural disaster. These are extremely complex circumstances, very specific circumstances, and since there is no economy of scale, since these are small territories, they should be dealt with at a different level. So I wonder, what can the United Nations do? The office that the United Nations has for small island developing states, how is it empowered? What resources does it have to provide assistance? The small island developing states, in the context of climate change, have produced an initiative with a great deal of effort, for insurance, for damages. We've managed to produce something for this, but I wonder how the IMF could cooperate with the small island developing states so that this mechanism to protect against losses and damages for small island developing states can really be made operational. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Excellency, for your comments and the questions, which we will address after I take two more comments, if that is okay. Good. I now call on the distinguished representative of the European Union.
Merci, Madame la.
Thank you, Madam Moderator. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for these very informative presentations, which shed light on the challenges and opportunities that we have concerning the various problems in small island development states, now in English.
It's good to also use the other languages of the UN, so I use this opportunity to use French. As European Union and its member states, we have a long-standing concern for the challenges and the difficult conditions faced by SIDS. We were there very actively in Barbados, in Mauritius, and in all the steps of the preparations for the Samoa Conference so far. We're bringing some global, regional, national support from the EU and its member states. And I know and I heard the message from the distinguished ambassador from Kiribati, it's never enough and it never goes quickly where it matters. I know there's a lot of studies, there's a lot of reports. Reporting studies are good, as we heard from the last speaker from the University of Las Palmas. They are also needed. One of the studies is the one you have on your table, the Vulnerability Resilience Profile. This is funded by, inter alia, the European Union. And I think dues also definitely contribute to more concrete actions on the ground. As a committed donor, the EU and its member states, I mean, we counted the EU ODA, and we've reached more than 2 billion euros for the SIDS countries in development. I hope some of this will go on the ground and not only in support in consultants and studies. I'm pretty confident it goes also in very concrete actions in many of the different seeds. Actually, we heard from the first presenter from Mauritius that some of it, of the plan, was also supported by this. So I'm confident we can really make concrete actions on the ground. Another comment I was really thrilled, and it's extremely important to have all the information given to us by the representative of the IMF. I was myself looking at some of those numbers and realized that vulnerability is, I mean, 6 of the 10 countries with the highest proportion of losses provoked by disasters are SIDS. And I came into a very, very telling number. Katrina in 2005 represented a loss of 1% of the GDP of the United States, while Ivan in Granada in 2004 represented 212% of the GDP. So those keeping those numbers indeed show us how most of the seeds are vulnerable and when they are exposed to natural and environmental disasters and climate change. But let me make one last comment on resilience, which is the theme of this debate. We have just recently adopted in the EU a new approach to resilience, which underscores the independence between vulnerability and poverty, and stresses how the natural and the man-made disasters and climate change exacerbate poverty, vulnerability, and fragility. And this new approach also tries to bring together political dialogue, development, and humanitarian work in an integrated manner in order to bring a more comprehensive and coherent approach to achieve more effective results on the ground. There's multi-sectoral interventions, and to make it short, we have this month actually have integrated those aspects in our development and humanitarian programming, and little by little all the member states are also integrating this new approach to resilience, and I hope it is going to make some differences on the ground. I would like to ask two questions to the distinguished panelists. One of them is about actors that we haven't really heard yet, the private sector and the role of women. Both, for very, very different reasons, I think have a very specific and very important role in order to help us answer those questions on vulnerability and resilience. And I would like to have the panelists' thoughts on the role of the private sector and the extremely important role of women. And my second question would be, given the differences that we've heard between the SIDS, Pacific, Caribbean, and the very distinct and various challenges we heard, what are the panelists' views on how can we give a global answer to the whole SIDS with in mind the different needs and the different issues faced by every one of the different SIDS? Thank you very much.
Thank you indeed. Distinguished representative of the European Union, for your comments and your questions. And now I pass the floor to the distinguished representative of Brazil. Okay.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair, and allow me through you to thank the panelists for a very informative and very interesting presentations. I would also like to thank the second committee chair for convening this timely meeting on such an important issue as we prepare for the upcoming conference of the small island developing states. Brazil takes this opportunity to reiterate its commitment to the sustainable development of the small island developing states. As other member states mentioned during this debate, Brazil believes that SIDS face specific and unique challenges, especially with regards to climate change, in view of their particular vulnerabilities. The promotion of sustainable development is a collective responsibility, and the challenges of SIDS are challenges all of us must face. Brazil has been partnering with SIDS in many areas to promote sustainable development, such as energy, including support for zoning for biofuels production, food security, human resources, marine environment, sports, health, and climate change. Brazil believes that political dialogue and international cooperation, including South-South cooperation, can and should play an important role in furthering of the CID's agenda. In the Caribbean, Brazil established embassies in all countries of the Commonwealth of CARICOM and appointed ambassadors to CARICOM and to the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States. In Africa and Asia, Brazil has partnered with the Portuguese-speaking CIDs, São Tomé and Príncipe, Cape Verde, Guinea-Bissau, and Timor-Leste, to share our experience in different areas that are key to sustainable development. In the Pacific, Brazil is expanding its political dialogue and identifying areas for cooperation. Brazil formally established diplomatic relations with the Kingdom of Tonga in 2011, and now we have diplomatic relations with all CIDs that are member states of this organization. Madam Chair, the strengthened cooperation with CIDs and the political dialogue Brazil established with those countries raised our awareness of the need for continued urgent and concrete action for the small island developing states. Reducing the vulnerability of CIDs and strengthening their resilience is a matter that concerns us all. Efforts in this regard were presented, as we all know, in the Barbados and Mauritius meetings and outcomes, as well as in Agenda 21, Johannesburg Plan of Implementation, and more recently in the Rio Plus 20 outcome document, The Future We Want. While some advances have been made, progress has been uneven and, frankly, insufficient. Serious and pressing challenges remain, as was very well highlighted by our distinguished ambassador from Cuba. The Rio Plus 20 outcome document contains the decision to convene in 2014 the third International CIDS Conference in Samoa. Brazil supported that decision and is looking forward to engaging and supporting the conference's preparatory process. The General Assembly declared 2014 the International Year of CIDS. We hope that the opportunity will be used to raise awareness of CIDS issue and to promote actions, including through international, regional, and sub-regional cooperation, aimed at achieving the sustainable development of the small island developing states. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative of Brazil, for sharing the information on how Brazil has cooperated and continues to support CIDS. We've had three comments resulting in several questions to the panel, questions with respect to the presentation by Mr. Alam on the slide, and then, of course, with respect to resources that would be available to assist CIDS in building resilience. And then we've had a general question to the panel on the role of the private sector and the role of women in this regard. And second, perhaps more directed to IMF again, given the differences across the regions, how can we develop a global answer to CIDS in this regard? And actually, we could probably open that a little bit broader and not just to the IMF. But thank you very much. I'll now give the floor to Mr. Alam first, and then we can move down the panel as such.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to respond to the insightful questions. Let me assure the representative from Cuba that by no intention was I suggesting that small states or CIDs are more prone to problems of governance or security or civil unrest. My slide was intended to give a comprehensive sense of the sort of shocks that CIDs might be vulnerable to. There have been one or two instances of civil unrest that have created problems for small states. And in responding to that sort of shock, one would need to be aware of the particular characteristics of small states in helping governments in those circumstances. Certainly, small states with a small population gives itself to particularly participatory governance. So I can imagine, I haven't seen any statistics on this, but I imagine that governance could be better than large states. I don't know about that. On the second question of how to bring the budget back on track after a major shock, clearly this is a difficult issue. Often a large shock requires many years of disaster recovery expenditure. and one wouldn't want to cut that short, sacrifice that to fiscal austerity or fiscal stability or re-establishing fiscal buffers. But there does come a time when one would need to move the budget back on track. And I think one of the problems you've seen in the Caribbean and the high debt burden that many of those countries now carry is that the economies have been subject to shocks, and the public sector has responded to address those shocks and has ramped up public expenditure and infrastructure on safety nets. And then it has found it difficult politically and for other reasons to rein expenditure back again after that. And so it's found itself in a position of ratcheting higher levels of public expenditure and fiscal deficits, which has resulted in debt problems. So institutional arrangements need to be found to provide some sort of impetus back towards more balanced budgets after shocks, the impact of shocks wane. The last question from the Cuban representative was on how the IMF can help countries finance losses and damages from shocks, if I understood correctly. The IMF doesn't provide grants to countries, and I think grant financing is the most natural response to a country which has experienced a destruction of infrastructure. However, by providing advice and support to countries at an early stage of their response to a crisis, quite often IMF participation is a catalyst for others to come in. It unlocks grant financing and loan financing from other development partners. And I could mention that we've been working closely with our colleagues from the European Union in the design of a shocks facility that they're considering, and that might draw on some of the vulnerability assessments that we undertake for countries as a, small states as a whole and individual small states. In terms of the general question to the panel on the role for the private sector and the role for women, in terms of the private sector, I think that does bear a close examination. It's an important role. I think it's very easy to focus on the role of the public sector. I think turning back to the Caribbean example again, the many Caribbean countries, because of their small size, it's very difficult for the private sector to find its feet. You have diseconomies of scale, which are important to industries. You have a small market size, and so you tend to have gaps in the market. And when industries do establish, they tend to have monopoly power. And so there's a strong public sector regulatory role as a balance to that. But I think in many cases, the public sector has taken on a size that's perhaps larger than it ought to be relative to the private sector. And so part of the solution to engendering stronger competitiveness and growth in many countries will be to unlock scope for the private sector to play a larger role. In terms of the role of women, I think as macroeconomists, we don't tend to distinguish between genders in terms of the contributions on the macro front. I mean, I come from an institution which has got a woman managing director, and she's playing a very important role. We have recently issued a paper on the role of gender in macroeconomics, and I think that probably has relevance for small states, as well as any other countries. And last question on how to provide a global approach to SIDS, given their very different needs. I mean, I think the way I look at it is that SIDS have many common characteristics, and so it they form a natural community to bring together to look for problems, but they also have very different needs, and so a balance needs to be found between sort of common approaches, but also sensitivity to individual challenges. And I think one area that perhaps merits attention is looking at success stories, both in the developing and the advanced economies. small states that have risen to the challenges that they confront on an economic footing and have done very well. What is it that mark them out for their success? In some cases, it's because they're nestled among much larger countries, advanced economies, and they benefit from those neighboring markets. But in other cases, you've got more isolated small states that have done very well, and I think that would bear study. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alam. Can we then move on to Ambassador Barrow, if you'd like to comment?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And if I could start with the points raised by the distinguished representative of Cuba. I cannot agree more with the sentiments raised that it's not only about one specific vulnerability and that education cannot address it all, that there is the international environment to consider, economic and political. That is so true. Yeah, that is so true. And in fact, the presentation that I made, I was specifically asked to address that particular vulnerability on climate change. But if you want the whole lot of the vulnerabilities that we're looking at, I can definitely share that with you. But while on answering and on the issue of education, I thought it's important at this point in time to highlight that Kiribati has been working very closely with Cuba on the issue of education and upskilling our young people. This month, just last week, 7 doctors from Kiribati graduated from Cuba. And 6 weeks before that, another 7 doctors. And this is the first time ever in history that we've had 17 medical doctors graduating in 1 year. In previous years, we'd get one or two doctors graduating, but this time, this is a very big jump. And I want to thank you and your government for that, and we hope to continue the... You asked about other strategies, that education is not the only one. We agree entirely with you. We are looking at a multi-pronged approach in terms of how we are responding to climate change. And I mentioned one is migration with dignity. In the olden days, in traditional times, we speak to our young and we say, marry into the landed family. Now we say to our young men and our young women, marry into the highlands. Yeah, where the sea level rise won't reach you. On the point raised by the European Union about the magnitude of the assistance to small island developing states, I agree entirely with that as well. And in fact, the European Union has worked very closely and has been a very strong partner to Kiribati in addressing its sustainable development challenges, and in particular in development of alternative and sustainable energy with solar lighting, particularly for the outer islands. There was a point also raised about by the European Union on actors, the importance of actors from the private sector and the role of women. In Kiribati, the approach that we have taken, Madam Chair, is that we're far too small and our resources too limited to leave anyone out of the equation. In traditional times, in post-colonial period, there was a clear demarcation. You, the private sector, that's your area. You look after businesses. Government, this is our area. Churches, you look after the sermons on Sunday. There was a very clear demarcation of different roles. But the approach over recent years has been to be on a more inclusive, to take on a more inclusive approach so that resources available not only to the whole of government but to the whole of the nation are used and are involved in the dialogue towards nation building. And the role of women in Kiribati, more than 50% of our population are women. So the policy that we take is that if women are not roped in and involved in development and in sustainable development activities, it's akin to leaving half of the population, half of the resources. And again, being a small country and with limited resources, we cannot afford to do that. It's interesting because Kiribati is perhaps one of the most male-dominated societies in the Pacific. Yeah? We go to the traditional, you saw in the presentation about the traditional tier of leadership on the outer islands. There's no role for women there. Only men sit at the post of decision-making in the traditional meeting houses. But that does not say that women do not have a role. They talk to their husbands the day before and the day after. Yeah? If the points that she wanted reflected weren't raised in the traditional meeting, there will probably be only half a meal ready for him, for the man of the house. So there is a lot of inclusion of women in development dialogue. Just recently, in the case of Kiribati, just 2 weeks ago, government established for the first time a Ministry of Women's and Social Affairs. And this is a first ever for Kiribati. This is a first. And primarily, the push has been in recognition of the need to pull on all resources available to the country in the process of nation building. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm conscious of the time, and I know we have two more comments. So before I pass it on, if you wouldn't mind, I'll take those comments, and maybe you can integrate those in your responses. We have the permanent representative of Jamaica. Excellency, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Madam Moderator, Mr. Chairman. Thank you also to all the panelists for their very enlightening presentations. I just wanted to focus on one area as it relates, I think, more so to the Caribbean SIDS than it does to the Pacific SIDS. And it was highlighted very starkly in one of the graphs that was presented by the IMF representative. And it's that much more so than the Pacific SIDS, those of us in the Caribbean SIDS have very high public debt levels. And I think he did acknowledge that maybe this is related to the fact that we have had a lot of reductions in the levels of ODA. The Pacific SIDS have much more ODA than we do, and we have debt to GDP ratios that are between 80 and 140%. I know Jamaica wasn't one of the pool of countries that you looked at, but certainly for us, our debt-to-GDP ratio is 145%, and we have dwindling levels of ODA, and we have very real, very acute needs in terms of the need for development financing. We don't have the public space, the fiscal space, to finance everything that we need to do developmentally. And so, you know, where is that capital going to come from? And it's not going to come from ODA. We can't go back to the capital markets because we're already over-leveraged as it is. So I would submit to you that we need to look and see how we can mobilize more foreign direct investment or even portfolio flows of investment. And, you know, investors have their concerns. You know, they have governance concerns, they have market risk concerns, and I think there is a lot that we can do to allay their concerns. You know, there are a lot of reforms that we are doing hand in hand with the IMF right now in terms of reforming the tax system to make it more broad-based, reforming pensions to make sure that they're more actuarially sound and sustainable, strengthening the rule of law, reforming our governance systems, streamlining the bureaucracy. We hear about the cutting of the red tape, labor market reform. So there's a lot that we can do. But as the representative from Cuba said, a lot also depends on the external economic environment. So there are some things that are beyond our control that maybe the IMF can help us to do. There is more than enough capital out there. the total, you know, the global pool of savings. I think I saw in a report the other day that it's in the order of $17 trillion, and the global pool of capital under management, the global financial assets under management, is in the hundreds of trillions of dollars. So how can we reallocate those sums towards long-term financing? When you look at some of the primary financial institutions like pension funds and sovereign wealth funds and insurance companies, that you would think they would be perfect for development financing, because, you know, if you're an insurance company, you're a pension fund, your liabilities in terms of the payout of your liabilities are long-term. Your beneficiaries or your membership, you don't need to pay them out until 20, 30 years down the road. So you could better align that with development investments, which are by their very nature long-term. But you look at some of the incentives, some of the compensation incentives that go towards the intermediaries that manage these sums. If I'm a hedge fund intermediary or another intermediary that is managing a pension fund, and you look at how the game is rigged in favor of their compensation structures, you realize that it is in their, they're incentivized to take short-term, to make short-term investments at the expense of long-term investments. You know, that is how they get their bonuses. It's all based on short-term profit. So I'm just wondering to what extent we can work with the IMF to, I don't know, better incentivize or better encourage the reallocation of some of these huge sums that are out there. We will do our part in terms of what we can do for structural reform, and we are doing that locally. But there is no reason, I think, why you have such a huge sum. Some of it is parked on the sidelines, and some of it are deployed into short-term investments. And then how are you going to finance the development needs that we all need? As I said, just to wrap up, we can't depend on ODA because there is none, because we're in middle-income countries and have graduated, and we're overly leveraged in terms of going back to the capital markets. We can't go into a capital market. The risk premium, when you look at 105% debt-to-GDP ratio, just think we're getting into the 11-12% in terms of borrowing costs. So, you know, maybe there's something, Mr. Alam, that IMF can do to help us in terms of the external environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Excellency, for that comment. And we will get to that. We've run in short of time. I have 10 minutes. I have two more comments to hear from Nauru and Papua New Guinea, and I close the list at that point. Nauru, you have the floor, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Let me begin I'll be just quick. I just have 2 points to raise, given the time. But let me just thank the distinguished panelists for their valuable insights. And as the United Nations has recognized and reaffirmed many instances that SIDS face special challenges. For me, I have to highlight that for climate change is a defining challenge of our generation, as we have heard from the panelists, especially Ambassador from Kiribati. In the next 2 years, as a solution, there are a number of important opportunities for the international community to take bold action. The third International Conference on SIDS, the UN Secretary General's Leaders Summit in 2014, and the development of the International Climate Change Agreement to be signed in 2015, which must make key progress in Warsaw in a couple of weeks' time if we are to be successful. So I would just like to highlight that. And the other issue that key important issue for SIDS is on oceans and seas. And basically, healthy oceans and seas is essential to deliver on 3 pillars of sustainable development. Based on they are the critical source of our livelihoods and are, of course, important elements for the people of the SIDS. So we would like this prominently reflected in the sustainable development goals in the post-2015 development agenda. So I have those 2 points just to highlight, and I guess we will look forward to reinvigorating the commitment of the international community for a global partnership to SIDS in 2014. Thank you.
Thank you, our dear friend from Nauru. And now I give the floor to the representative of Papua New Guinea.
Madam Chair, thank you for giving me the floor to speak. My intervention is basically a improvisation of a long statement which I have submitted on behalf of the Pacific Small Island Developing States, which has been posted on the Second Committee website. Let me also join the preceding speakers in conveying our gratitude for the panelists for the thought-provoking and sobering reminder to all of us of the challenges that we face as small island developing states. I should also thank the organizers for the timely event and encourage such strategic and focused discourse that can help catalyze and enhance the advocacy and articulation of SIDS sustainable development issues at all levels. The narrative of building, entrenching, and sustaining resilience for SIDS sustainable development is well documented in the litany of internationally agreed development frameworks within the UN and elsewhere for many decades and continue to evolve. Madam Chair, for us, the PSIDs, one of the fundamental issues is on the oceans and the seas. As we move towards the TED International Conference on Small Island Developing States, we want to remind everyone that ensuring a healthy, productive, and resilient ocean and seas is highly imperative. This is why we are advocating a standalone oceans and seas sustainable development goal in the post-2015 development agenda. PSIDs have a unique dependency on oceans and its resources for our livelihoods, food security, economies, and identities. The ocean remains our primary pathway to future sustainable economic growth, social progress, and vital component of our life support system. All of this must be preserved by all of us. It is therefore essential that the international community must join us and prioritize the protection and restoration of the health, productivity, and resilience of the oceans. For us, there are a number of strategies that we propose that could perhaps be avenues through which resilience can be embraced. This includes marine environment management and conservation, including coral reef protection, sustainable fisheries practices, including banning illegal, unregulated, and unreported fisheries, and remove subsidies that promote overfishing and encourage sub-regional and coastal fisheries management, as well as sustainable development of marine resources and the need to address sea and land-based pollution. Those for us are fundamental to the long-term survival and security of our communities. The second important issue for us, if I may, Madam Chair, is on the issue of sustainable energy. Many of the Pacific Small Island Developing States depend on fossil fuel, which is essentially very expensive and often not readily available. And the need to interact, or rather develop, partnership that is genuine and durable, as well as to provide concrete assistance to us to deal with renewable energy is the way forward in the longer term for us as part of the small island developing states. I thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your understanding. I wish I could stop the clock, but I can't, and I cannot choose that clock, which tells me I have a lot of time, and that clock, which tells me I have no time. So I will ask Dr. Mohammed and Mr. Mohammed and Dr. Rahidor to comment briefly on private sector role of women, and then Dr. Rahidor will do a brief comment on cooperation in general, and then I'll give the floor back to Mr. Alam, who can address the comment from the Distinguished Excellency Ambassador from Jamaica. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In as far as MID is concerned, the role of women is clearly highlighted. In as far as equity is concerned, we have an Equal Opportunities Commission in Mauritius that takes care of that. Most ministries and government departments now have a gender policy. And the breaking point was this year's last municipal election, whereby the law was amended, and it is now mandatory in Mauritius for every constituency in the country and political parties to have at least one-third women as candidate in Mauritius. And we have a lot of municipal council candidates, and we are now awaiting for next general election. In as far as the private sector is concerned, even the Prime Minister goes at the highest level to recognize the contribution of the private sector and asking them to do more. In fact, for MID to become a reality, the three P's have to be there: public sector, people sector, and private sector. And tangible examples are there. I mentioned earlier the investment that is coming from the private sector in Mauritius for the diversification of the electricity mix. They are forking out massively, and they are taking a huge risk, but government is accompanying with subsidy. In as far as economy and employment is concerned, the share of green job will increase only if the private sector is there, and they are playing the game. When MID was launched, one of the first things that Prime Minister did was to get international agencies like Agence Française de Développement in the country, and through its green loan, Agence Française de Développement has AFD has provided much funding to the private sector with interesting grants and interest rate. And they have well diversified their economic activities now to be more SD friendly. The recent Sea for All initiative of the European Union also goes a long way to encourage private sector into the specifically the energy, but SD in general. In Mauritius now, private sector can use 2% of their tax to ask, we call it corporate social responsibility, to address a lot of, to fund NGOs and other institutions to do projects that are in line with environment protection, the social landscape, and SD in general. And I think I will stop here. Thank you.
Dr. Rahidor, sorry.
Yeah. Creo que lo que hemos...
I think what we've been talking about today is basically a matter of emphasizing something that had been asked in previous meetings, and that is whether it's possible to have relationships among small island developing states, among them and for them. And we've seen here that it is possible, although we need to do further work on it. It's possible among the universities as well to cooperate. But the problems that we, the islands, have, whether or not we're states, the problems that we have are too large, they're too global, for us to be able to resolve them ourselves as islands. And this is why cooperation, alliances among islands, pooling our strength so that we can work together, it seems to me, is one of the critical elements for our work in SIDS. So the work that we have presented to you is an example of a formula for pooling strengths in the small island developing states. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rahidor. Now I give the floor to Mr. Alam for the last points.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very brief. It's a pleasure to hear from the ambassador from Jamaica. I know it took a long while to put in place, to adopt and design the ambitious program of reforms that they're implementing at the moment. We salute them in this. It's going, the program is going very well. We're just about to take our second quarterly, their second quarterly review to our board in the coming weeks. And I think the ambassador highlighted a lot of the important things that they're doing to boost competitiveness and resilience. The point he mentioned about the global capital pool of $70 trillion, I think that does offer some exciting prospects for countries that need capital. I mean, you are seeing countries now able to issue sovereign bonds who otherwise would have been locked out of that form of financing. Venture capital funds are being set up looking for opportunities to invest globally in locations that they wouldn't have gone to before. But I think we need to be cautious in terms of creating the right balance between having a supply of capital of investable funds and projects that generate attractive returns. I think it will be difficult to push capital into places where you don't have investment opportunities. And the best way to generate those investment opportunities is to undertake the sort of reforms that Jamaica is doing at the moment to boost growth and competitiveness. And I think in time you'll find that that will pay off in terms of attracting investment. I mean, in my last 10 years working on sub-Saharan Africa, I'm really struck now. You go to the hotels in the capitals in Africa and they're full of investors coming in from the major corporations, from investment companies looking for opportunities to invest in Africa. And I think that for our SIDS colleagues offers great promise. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Alam. And just to wrap up, we've had a very, very good exchange amongst panelists and delegates here. I think it is very evident that the special case for SIDS is real. SIDS are fighting in the face of major challenges from within and from without, but there are dynamic initiatives and partnerships afoot, and we must commend those, and we've heard of those already. Indeed, SIDS could very well face, as Ambassador Barra said, an uncertain future if we simply stand by. But the USG has reinforced to us that we have an international responsibility, if not legal, definitely a moral responsibility. So I hope that these contributions will enrich the debate that is forthcoming on sustainable development, as well as the global preparations for the third international conference on SIDS. Thank you, and now I pass the floor back to Mr. Chair.
Merci, Madame Le.
Thank you, Madam Moderator. I think I was inspired this morning to stay in my corner and to listen and learn. The permanent representative of Tuvalu came to see me a while ago to talk to me about the situation in his country. Tuvalu is among the SIDS and is facing climate change problems of coastal erosion, and it was set to be declassified to not be an LDC but an intermediate country by the Secretariat. However, Tuvalu has made progress, but it is still dependent on the ocean, on its resources, and it needs to face climate change problems. However, I didn't have any difficulty in convincing my government for Senegal to support Tuvalu in the ECOSOC session in Geneva to maintain them in this category. And Ambassador Barrow of Kiribati has shown us just how much the small island development states are threatened, and that we need to have international solidarity for them. I think this is the proper place as we prepare the third international conference on SIDS to note this again. I would like to thank you for your high-quality contributions and to tell you that truly this was a very interesting discussion for all of us. Moving forward to the APIA conference, the second committee needs to ensure that this conference takes place and is successful, because the SIDS are those who must face the most important challenges concerning climate change. And I encourage all delegations to always keep in mind the points that were evoked today so that we can seek solutions to the challenges faced by SIDS and so that we can ensure the success of the APEC conference. In particular, I would like to thank the eminent members of the panel, Mr. Osman Mohammed, Ambassador Margarita Barro, Mr. Peter Alam, and Mr. José Regidor Garcia, and especially our moderator, Ambassador Janine Guay-Felsen, as well as the Undersecretary General for Economic and Social Affairs, Mr. Wu, and all of those who participated in the debate today. Ladies and gentlemen, you have brought coherence to the topics of vulnerability and resilience of small island developing states. Together, these two topics bring us an idea of the difficulties that these countries are facing and also some of the solutions for these problems. We are very grateful for that. Therefore, before adjourning, I would like to inform delegations that the next plenary meeting of the Second Committee will be held on 4 November at 10 o'clock, that's Monday, and the Second Committee will be considering Agenda Item 19, Sustainable Development, sub-items A to J. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.